I'd like to take a moment to review the first three sermons in this series on biblical manhood and womanhood. We began by taking a look at our modern 21st century culture. In an effort to assess the status of men and women, husbands and wives, marriage and family in our nation today. Sadly, what we found was not encouraging. Clearly, our nation is in the process of pursuing inclusion, acceptance, justice, and tolerance for all by tearing down the old models of male and female, marriage and family, and replacing them with new and improved versions. In so doing, they are tampering with God-ordained institutions and principles that were established at creation and designed by our Creator to form the foundation for mankind's happiness and fulfillment. We are witnessing the dramatic decline of American families, of American fathers, and it's fueled by a full-blown retreat from the traditional marriage model and a social agenda that demands equality of the sexes, same-sex marriages, and generally speaking, deconstructing the God-ordained roles of men and women. That's what we discovered in the first part of this series. And of course, what a challenge for those with the Spirit of God to reflect these godly principles in their roles as modern-day men and women, husbands and wives. What a challenge we all face. In part two of the series, we focused on defining and describing the masculine male from the biblical perspective. And in part three, we sought to do the same for the feminine female in looking at the Scripture to determine what the Bible actually has to say about our roles, our gender roles, made and created by our loving Heavenly Father from creation. So this afternoon in part four, I would like to pull together what we have covered in the past three sermons and explore the practical application of these biblical principles in our modern 21st century world. How is all of this supposed to work? How is it all supposed to come together? Can men and women who seek to fulfill their God-ordained roles survive in our modern world? Well, let's begin by reviewing some basic premises and principles that we can glean from the creation account. This will harken back to the first sermon in this series, but I'd like to lay the groundwork for our discussion of practical application by going back to the beginning and highlighting just a few concepts so we can build the foundation and establish the foundation, I should say, of our discussion this afternoon on the fundamentals of creation and God's intent from the beginning, and then move into the practical application of the concepts and the principles that we've been discussing for the past several weeks. First of all, mankind, male and female, were both made in the image of God. And of course, one is not superior to the other. It is not a question of superiority and inferiority. It took both male and female to create the full image of God. It could not be done with just one. God created mankind, male and female. They were both created to have dominion over certain aspects, in fact, all aspects of the creation. They were to have dominion. There was no hint of superiority or inferiority at the time of creation. Mankind was to be the dominant force in creation. And of course, our adversary, Satan the devil, was the dramatic and dynamic, powerful source in the creation before the creation of Adam and Eve, wasn't he? And so his resentment to being replaced, if you will, by Adam and Eve and physical human beings was high, and he proved that in just two chapters. In fact, chapter 3, he came on the scene, and things haven't been the same since, have they? Both Adam and Eve were created to have dominion, and God pronounced all of this very good. So he pronounced it very good, and we have to assume that God is correct, don't we? When he said it was very good, creating us male and female. There's something very important about the gender that God created, and he proclaimed them very good. Notice that God did not create us man and wife, or husband and wife. He first and foremost created us male and female. Male and female. He established marriage as a divine institution, and of course he brought together the first man and woman of necessity as husband and wife, encouraged them to be fruitful and multiply so that the human race could propagate, and that not only the human family would grow, but also God's family, because as we know, that's ultimately God's purpose for mankind. Now, in the course of preparing to create Eve, and I'm going to try to pull just a few highlights from the creation account, as I said, to lay the foundation this afternoon, God said that it was not good for man to be alone. It's not good for males to be alone, not just husband, but males. Males, men, need the modifying, refining, sensitive, caring impact of females to influence and encourage them. We need that. If we are left alone in our man cave to bounce around and do the things that we men like to do, it is really not healthy for us. It's not a balanced thing. God knew that. And that's why he designed a help meet or appropriate for us. And male and female complement one another. And it is that way in society and culture, apart from marriage, but it's especially true within the confines of the marriage covenant. Husbands and wives were designed to complement one another. But please don't overlook the additional component of males and females being designed to complement one another. And can you imagine if that were understood, just that one factor, brought back into society and culture and suddenly completely overwhelming all of the other stuff that is out there? What if we actually viewed male and female genders as being healthy and complementary, and something God ordained and established to give our lives the kind of happiness, fulfillment, abundance, and joy that he intended for us to have from the very beginning. But as we'll see, it didn't take long for these elements of God's creation to be challenged and to be dramatically changed. Now, marriage, as I mentioned, is potentially the ultimate expression of that complementary condition and relationship. But there are certainly other ways and other relationships in which men and women can and should complement one another. We're going to talk about those in a few minutes. Now, just as an aside, as we talk about the creation, as we talk about genders, I've got a couple of book titles that I want to throw in the mix here to get you thinking about men and women, males and females. If you're a man, you might think you understand what it's like to be a woman, because after all, you've seen a few, and you may have lived with one, or you may have a sister, so what's the big deal? They're just built a little differently, but aren't they basically the same? And if you're a woman, you think, well, I had a brother, so I know what men are like, I know what men want. Wasn't there a movie out about I Know What Women Want or something like that years ago, and kind of a funny title, but let's face it, most men don't know exactly what women want because women don't know exactly what they want all the time. It does change, and that's part of their nature. We're kind of straight-line people. Men are kind of straight-line. Women are squiggly, and it moves. And let me, for instance, illustrate by a couple of book titles. Women are like spaghetti. Men are like waffles. So men like compartmentalized. Okay, this is here. We're talking about this. Let's keep talking about this. Let's not quit talking about this until we've exhausted the topic. That's the waffle in men. Now, women are like spaghetti. There are no compartments in spaghetti. Nothing is divided or separated in spaghetti. Everything is connected. Everything is connected. From the minutest thing on the table in front of you to the galaxies and the universe, it is all connected. And sometimes women can take you on a conversational tour of all of the above. And meanwhile, you're back at the ranch, stuck in this little waffle hole, wondering, where is she going with this? And sometimes your mind wanders, sometimes you wander, and the connection is not there. But these are characteristics that are real. And it's not wrong to be a waffle, and it's not wrong to be spaghetti, is it? But to be aware of it is very helpful. Here's another title. Men are like clams. Women are like crowbars. In other words, men are not nearly as verbose. We don't tend to talk as much as females. So women tend to get nervous if someone isn't talking. And so women sometimes act as crowbars and try to pry the clam open and get the clam to start talking. But sometimes the clam feels the pressure of the crowbar and is not interested in talking because the crowbar is not a motivational factor for the clam. So we could go on with several other book titles, but I think you get the point. We are different. But as the French say, vive la différence. Long live the differences. And I'm afraid that there are people in our society, in our culture, and in our world, powerful spiritual forces, if you will, Satan the devil being among them, that would like to erase those differences and destroy what God created. He's been at it from the very beginning. Consider, could God have intended that the inherent weaknesses of the male would call forth the inherent strengths of the female and vice versa? Could God have been that savvy to have created the genders to complement each other to the point where if both were brought together, the weaknesses of one would be supported and infused with energy and increased by the other and vice versa to the point where the two working together could accomplish much more than each of them working separately, individually, independently? Could it be? Could it be? And really, to ask the question almost begs the answer. I believe it could happen, but has it ever been tried? Has it ever been tried? It seems that from the Garden of Eden, chapter 3, when Eve usurped Adam's responsibility, made the choice to take of the forbidden fruit, if you will, and Adam took the fruit from his wife, he didn't fulfill his leadership role. Eve made her mistake and her error. All of the elements or all of the individuals involved in that event were cursed, from the snake to Eve to Adam. And all of us have been paying the penalty. Have men and women ever understood their roles and exercised them in a godly fashion, in a consistent way down through the centuries? I would say, generally speaking, no. And certainly in our 21st century, there are efforts afoot to make it even more difficult to bring godly principles to the table and apply them. Because as we read some of the scriptures this afternoon, as we look at some of these biblical principles, I want you to try to envision a public program on television promoting the submission of women and the leadership of men. How popular would that be? What would the ratings be on something like that? It wouldn't go over well. And that's just the world in which we live. And many have misapplied the principles of Scripture. Many have misunderstood them. There's a lot of sensitivity out there. And I realize that there may be some offense by the words that I say this afternoon. And I don't mean to offend anyone. I am simply trying to illustrate the biblical principles and put forth some possibilities as to how they might be applied. But ultimately, it comes down to you and to me taking a hold of these principles and applying them in our lives. Now let's continue our review here of some of the fundamentals of creation and the issues that occurred there. As I mentioned, sin dramatically altered the ideal relationship that God envisioned for males and females. Men and women, husbands and wives. From the very beginning, the first marriage got off to a rocky start. I would imagine that Adam and Eve were not happy after they were excluded and put out of the garden. I would not have been happy. If I could just pick whatever food I wanted, it was a very relaxing atmosphere. Now I have to dig in the dirt and plant seeds. I have to get my own food in the sweat of my brow. You know, all the things that God said would happen as a result of that mistake, that error, that sin, that transgression of His law and His command not to eat of that fruit. And specifically to Eve, I think it's important that we focus on the curse that God placed upon Eve and upon the female gender. Your desire will be for your husband, and he shall rule over you. Basically, that's what happened. Eve's relationship with her husband would change as a result of their sin. The complementary nature of their relationship would turn toward strife, competition, envy, jealousy, etc. And generally speaking, men have tended to be somewhat abusive, dismissive, and condescending toward women down through the centuries. It's still happening in some cultures and societies. Just consider the rape incidents in India recently. It's kind of sport over there to do that kind of thing to females. It's horrific. It's repulsive. It's disgusting. But it is part of culture and society. And, of course, from pornography to hundreds of other ways to pervert the impression and the image of the pure and holy and righteous gender-specific traits and characteristics that God designed and put in place for our benefit, that He said were very good. We have so sullied them, so perverted and distorted them, that I don't know if we can really grasp how far down we have come, nor because of the pressure from the culture that surrounds us. Similar to what we talked about last week, Lot in Sodom and Gomorrah. His perspective was altered dramatically. His ability to see principles clearly was affected by the daily exposure to what he saw and what he heard in that evil, corrupt city. And we are in a similar situation. Obviously, these curses that affected Adam and Eve have affected male and female relationships at all levels, and especially in marriage. And at this point, I want to emphasize one thing. God created and designed man to assume a leadership role in male, female, and husband-wife relationships. That was the design. How that leadership role is exercised is of supreme importance, as we shall see. So let's continue now and get into some of the nitty-gritty of some of the basics. First of all, the primary characteristics of males and females, masculine men and feminine women. Now, I've taken this information from Recovering Biblical Manhood and Womanhood by Piper and Gershon, I believe is his last name. We'll have some other quotes from both of them. Wayne Grudem, excuse me. Recovering Biblical Manhood and Womanhood, edited by John Piper and Wayne Grudem. And here are some of the essential qualities that will identify a feminine female. A feminine female. At the heart of mature femininity is a freeing disposition to affirm and receive and nurture strength and leadership from worthy men in ways appropriate to a woman's differing relationships. A respectful, considerate response to male initiative and leadership, a disposition to yield to, and an inclination to follow, motivated by a spirit and attitude of submission. The three key elements of femininity as far as their characteristics: nurturing, supportive, and submissive. Nurturing, supportive, and submissive. As far as the essence of masculinity is concerned, let's take a look at that. This is of my own creation. The successful progression from physically strong, sexually aggressive, somewhat irrational, and incompetent, which describes my attempt to describe a young teenager, male, to a benevolent, non-threatening, humble, caring, charitable, well-meaning, kind, unselfish approach toward others, especially toward females. A sincere desire, a sense of duty and obligation to lead, protect, and provide. So for the males, the three qualities I've identified as fundamental and primary: lead, protect, and provide. For females, nurturing, supportive, and submissive. And males should act this way and portray these attitudes of leadership, protection, and provision for females in appropriate ways within the context of their various relationships, be they their mother, their sister, their grandmother, female friends, teachers, fellow employees, and if married, his wife. So to think that God's directives for male and female relationships and gender differences and the complementary nature of the genders is limited to the marriage relationship and does not affect other relationships beyond marriage, I think is short-sighted. And I don't think it gives God the credit, nor does it give the fullness of understanding to us as human beings in terms of how understanding these elements, these fundamental elements of maleness and femaleness, if you will, masculinity and femininity, could help us improve our relationships and really improve the world. Let's turn now to 1 Timothy chapter 2. These are very important verses, and I want to continue to lay the groundwork by looking at these verses, reviewing them briefly, and then moving into some elements of our discussion on principles. 1 Timothy chapter 2. Verse 8. I desire, therefore, that the men pray everywhere, lifting up holy hands without wrath and doubting. Of course, these are basic directives to men and women in the church who have claimed a spiritual kinship with one another and, of course, with Jesus Christ. The men are to be praying always, everywhere, lifting up holy hands without wrath, without doubting. They are to be expressing and extending spiritual leadership, the spiritual leadership that Adam did not extend. He was not there. And when he was there, he made the wrong choice, didn't he? In like manner, also the women adorn themselves in modest apparel, with propriety and moderation, not with braided hair or gold or pearls or costly clothing, but which is proper for women professing godliness with good works. Now, there's nothing wrong with an attractive garment, with gold bracelets or pearls or expensive jewelry. No, the key here is modest apparel, in moderation, and in addition, you're not trying to draw attention to your external appearance. You are far more concerned about your heart, your mind, and your attitude. You are professing godliness. You are not showing an ostentatious display of physical beauty, clothing, or other items. That's the essence of a woman of God in the context of your relationship with one another in the church. It is, again, an ecclesiastical directive here, if you will, in these verses primarily. But now in verse 11, let a woman learn in silence with all submission. And I do not permit a woman to teach or to have authority over a man, but to be in silence. Now, this is, again, in the congregational or church setting. Essentially, women are not to instruct men in the Scripture. This is a direct quote from the letter of Paul to Timothy in the Scripture, inspired Word of God. Somehow, we have to recognize that this is a directive. It is not culturally directed to the first century. It is a principle that is clearly outlined here. And that's why in the church we do not have female preachers or teachers in the sense of preaching on the Sabbath. This is the principle that is outlined here. But getting on to verse 13, Adam was formed first, then Eve. So the order of creation is brought out by Paul. Adam was not deceived, but the woman, being deceived, fell into the transgression. It was not as if she went out that day, headed right for the tree and grabbed the fruit. She fell into the transgression. She fell into the transgression. In other words, is there a proclivity within females in general? Are they more susceptible to being deceived and drawn away, distracted? And is it a matter of Eve simply falling into the transgression? And then once she was in it, she found herself again looking at her husband in a different way after the fact. And if indeed she did usurp her authority as the wife of Adam and partake of the fruit and offer it to him, he still failed to lead and took the fruit. And in the ultimate sense, when God pronounced the curse on Adam and Eve, was the consequence now that Eve would be under the boot of her husband. She would be under the authoritarian dynamic, and men in general would be somewhat abusive toward women because of this, because of that attempt to usurp authority. I do not know all of the details, but I do know that there is a great deal of information that illustrates the need for us to be conscious of the two primary roles of men and women, husbands and wives. Men are to be the leaders, husbands are to be the leaders. And women are to be submissive and respectful. These are very general terms. And we're going to try to clarify and illuminate some of these concepts as we go down the road this afternoon. Women, of course, have many opportunities to serve in the church that relate to their primary roles as females, wives, mothers, etc., and as appropriate within the stated general parameters and guidelines of Scripture. We are all part of a body. Because women cannot preach, does that mean they cannot impact on the lives of men and women in the congregation? Of course they can. I want to recall the case that we have talked about so many times, Abigail's situation. Abigail had a tremendous influence on her husband and on King David. didn't she? And she was not grabbing the authority. She didn't take a charge of the situation. She humbly guided both of those gentlemen to better decisions and better outcomes. Sadly for her husband, it wasn't the best of outcomes. But on balance, she exercised a great deal of feminine ingenuity and intuition and accomplished something that only a woman of her caliber and her persuasion could have accomplished in that situation. The body metaphor is good to keep in mind because we are all an important part of the body. Nobody is a secondary member of the body. You need all of your organs. And men desperately need women. Husbands desperately need wives. We both, as genders, need each other. And we're going to talk about those important needs and how we can fulfill them within the context of these general roles and responsibilities as we go forward this afternoon. God saw fit to make us male and female for a reason, to fulfill His great purpose. To deny that is a great tragedy and a grievous sin for which there will be consequences. And there already are, sadly, in our culture and in our society. So when we read here in 1 Timothy chapter 2 about women learning in submission, about the order of creation, about Eve being deceived and falling into the transgression, there are elements here that can help us understand why God designed the genders as He did and what His intentions were from the beginning and how we can bring ourselves as individual Christians back to the fundamentals and, if necessary, reformulate ourselves to fit within these parameters and guidelines and reflect our godly traits and characteristics as males and females within the confines and the directives of scriptural principle. So now I'd like to move to the concept of submission. The concept of submission. You know, in one sense, we are all called to submit, aren't we? Submission has been viewed, I think, as an unpleasant, unsavory thing. Men get to have all the fun. Men are the leaders. They get to make all the decisions. And all women can do is submit. That's all they can do. Well, is that what submission means? And is that what leadership means? Well, I think those two opposite poles are a long ways away from the truth and certainly do not reflect God's intent. But I do want to emphasize the need for all of us to submit, for all of us to become servants, if you will, in that context. That's a responsibility of all of us as Christians. Notice in Matthew chapter 20, verse 26. Christ is speaking to His disciples. He's talking about Gentiles and how they rule over people. They lord it over people. They are abusive and they exercise their authority in inappropriate ways. Verse 26, it shall not be so among you. That's what Christ said. So no Christian husband, no Christian man, no husband, no man should treat his wife in that fashion. It's unconscionable. And here's how we should all treat one another. Whoever wants to be great or become great among you, let him become your servant. And whoever desires to be first among you, let him become your slave. And basically, at the Garden of Eden, chapter 3, instead of being complementary, Adam and Eve became competitive. And we have seen that competitive edge in male-female husband-wife relationships for millennia. And that competition and that strife and that seeking for power and control and authority has eroded and corrupted our relationships. And to come back to the basics and to get the idea that greatness comes from service, and to be a true servant, you must become a slave and disregard your own desires and make the desires and the needs and the requirements of others your desire to fulfill. That is the mark of a real servant, not someone who's in charge or in authority or in control. What's one of the worst things a husband can say to his wife? I'm in charge here. Well, if you have to say it, you know you're not really in charge here. And that is not conducting your business or reflecting your maleness or your husbandly characteristics as you should. So this business of authority, this desire to be in charge, to be in control, both males and females are guilty of it. And sometimes in the female, because of insecurity, because of frustration, because of fear, there are many motivators. But sometimes women feel as though they have to take control. Why? Because the man or the husband isn't. And they sense that if the man does take control, that disaster is not too far away. And so in order to avoid disaster, they often reach over and grab the wheel and bring it over and start steering. And sometimes that works, sometimes that doesn't. But there are all kinds of dynamics at work in relationships, and it's very difficult to discuss them all in this series, but I do want to illustrate some principles, as I said, as we go down the road here. In Galatians 5 and verse 17, there's an important principle that I want to bring out here that affects all of our human relationships and our relationship with God. In Galatians 5, verse 17, "For the flesh lusts against the spirit, and the spirit against the flesh, and these are contrary to one another, so that you do not do the things that you wish." And when the Spirit tells you to love and respect women, to love and respect your wife, to be patient, to be kind, to be a provider, to put your desires in a secondary position and seek to give yourself to your wife, your children, give yourself to your female companions and your female co-workers and serve them and not be as conscious of your maleness as you are of the need to be a servant. If these are the attitudes that you're expressing and want to express, there is something else that's going on inside of you that is fighting that. And if you are a female in the workplace or in the home place and you want to submit, but it's hard and you have a husband who is not leading as you want him to lead, and so you want to take the lead, so there's the battle inside of you. Or you're in the workplace and your boss is a male and you're a female and you're wincing under that leadership or under that yoke. And there's a battle inside of you as to how you will respond to that. So this is the reality. And sadly, this does affect our conduct in many of our relationships. And sometimes we aren't even aware of it. Because you know what? We're usually pleased with how we respond and react in every case, aren't we? Think about it. No, I handled that pretty well. Maybe I could have done a few things, but I really didn't have a choice. She made me do it, or he said that. Well, I had to say this, and on we go. We are good at modifying what really happened, making it fit into a positive perspective so that we don't have to feel guilty. That's one of the worst things. We do not want to be guilty. We don't want to feel guilty. We don't mind putting that on others, but we don't want it ourselves. And so all of these dynamics are at work. And even when I read some of these verses, do you find yourself wincing a little bit? Do you find yourself, oh, I don't know about that. I couldn't submit to that. Well, I don't think I have to put up with that. Well, let's keep reading. Let's keep looking. Let's keep studying. I've got another word for you. The Scripture says the meek will inherit the earth. And I found this definition of weakness, or meekness rather, It's not weakness. Meekness is what? Restrained power. Restrained power. I really like that. Meekness is restrained power. You've got the power, but you can restrain it. You could wear the pants, but you don't. That's an old saying that's even out of vogue now, and it's probably offensive because everyone wears pants today. But if you're over 80, you know what I'm talking about. So, it's a matter of taking a look at our own attitudes. Meekness is restrained power. Restrained power. How much power did Abigail have? The servants came to her. They didn't come to her husband. He lived up to his name. His name was Fool or Foolish. He made unwise decisions. He was an alcoholic, apparently. He was drunk at the time he spurned David, and he went home and fell asleep. Meanwhile, back at the ranch, here comes David, ready to destroy everything that he owned. Everything. And his wife intervened in a dramatic and a powerful way. She had the power to tell her servants, grab some armaments, let's go out there and defend our property, here comes David. She didn't do that. She came with meekness, with restrained power. Did Eve have the power to take of that fruit? Did she have the power to deny her husband's leadership? Sure she did. She exercised that power. What if she would have restrained it and said, no, I'm not going to, I know I could, but I'm not going to do it. I'm going to check with Adam first. Now, it probably wouldn't have done any good because he took the fruit anyway. But the point is, meekness is restrained power. And most of us, male or female, like to view ourselves as what? Independent. We love our independence. We don't want to lose our driver's license. We don't want to be viewed as weak or insufficient. We want to keep getting up out of our chair ourselves, even if it's really hard to transfer. That's what they call that, getting up out of a chair, transferring. I call it moving to another city, but I'm younger. I'm not confronted with that yet. I'm not too far away. We don't like to admit any weakness, any frailty. We want to maintain what many of us have referred to as a fiercely independent attitude. And that is totally contrary to male and female characteristics, husband and wife characteristics. But we like that perception, and we like to push that, and we like to make sure that everybody knows that we are independent. That works with men and women, but it is especially unsettling in women when that independent spirit so overwhelms every other spirit that there is not a hint of submission anywhere. And that is sad, because a fulfilling life is not to be had under those conditions or circumstances. Now, we talked a little bit about what men want from women. Is it sex or is it respect? I say it's respect. It's respect. And women who stop trying to control men and respond to them with trust and respect and submission will in most cases see an increase in responsible conduct and behavior. For then the man will have to heed his own direction and his own intuition instead of following yours. But turning the garment off is not easy. If you get my drift. Garmin is the global positioning device that you put on your dash that tells you where to turn and where to go. And sometimes ladies have Garmin-like tendencies. And turning that off and allowing a wrong turn, allowing a late arrival, allowing mistakes and errors, will not prove to be the end of the world. But it could be the beginning of a more meaningful relationship between you and your husband, between you and your male friend. It's something to consider. I read a sign in a store the other day. If I agree with you, we will both be wrong. Think about it. The headstrong, independent, I'm right, that doesn't play well. That does not play well in either male or female gender. But if the female tends to be that way, it's going to squelch the male and vice versa. Vice versa. What did Christ say in John 5, verse 30? We're talking about submission here. And being fiercely independent is not being submissive. Saying, if I agree with you, we'll both be wrong is not. Christ said, I can of my own self do nothing. Now, if Christ said that, what are we going to say? Well, thank God I can at least do something. No. If Christ said, I can of my own self do nothing, what can you and I do? But you see, we get to be so independent and so inward in our perspective on life that the world revolves around us. And we are not able to see how that perspective on our part affects our relationships and undermines what could be a more effective and a more beneficial relationship with many people, not to mention your spouse. So in this case, submission is something Christ constantly did to his Father. Christ was submissive. Christ was submissive to his Father. He was submissive even unto the death of the cross. So is it such a bad thing to have submission held up as your primary characteristic? Is it so bad? Are there good things? Of course there are good things about it. Could you be taken advantage of? Of course you could be taken advantage of. Was Christ taken advantage of? Of course he was. Has everyone in this room, regardless of their gender, been taken advantage of? Of course they have been. But if you're going to become a servant and a slave, then yes, people may take advantage of you. But you don't have to tolerate it. You don't have to put up with it. But you don't necessarily need to react in a violent way, do you? Remember Abigail. Remember others. Remember a soft answer turns away wrath. Most of us believe more wrath will turn away wrath. You hit me once, I'll hit you twice. You shoot me once, I'll shoot you twice. That isn't an effective way to resolve arguments. I guess it brings an end to something, but it doesn't resolve anything. Now, I've got a few comments here, once again, from Biblical Manhood and Womanhood by Piper and Grudem. Here's what submission is not. Here's what submission is not. Submission is not giving up independent thoughts. Giving up independent thoughts. Oh, if I'm going to be submissive, I have to think just like my husband. The only problem is he doesn't think. So I've got to stop thinking. No, that's not true. Abigail did not stop thinking. Submission is not giving up trying to influence your husband or other males for that matter. The difference between controlling and influencing is dramatic. Females have a powerful influence on males, period. And I'm talking way beyond the sexual innuendo of that comment. I don't even want to talk about that. That's true, and it's there. It's natural. It's unavoidable. I'm not denying it. But there are many other ways that women can influence men in such dramatic and profound ways that you can take a hothead like David, who is about to destroy his reputation, kill hundreds of people, destroy other people's property, etc., etc. She stopped him in his tracks and didn't even use a gun. That is influence. Tremendous example. Submission is not giving in to every demand of your husband or other males, especially if the demand is inappropriate, ungodly, etc., etc. Submission is not based upon lesser intelligence or competence. Again, I said the genders are not a matter of one is inferior and the other is superior. Men are not omniscient. I hate to tell all of us this, but it is true. Men are not omniscient. I know there may be some in here that are, but eventually someone will ask the question and you will have to admit, I don't know. Men are not omniscient. God did not create them to be the leaders and the providers and the caregivers, if you will, in that context, because they have superior intelligence. Because there are many women who have a higher IQ and more intelligence than men. It just that is not a factor. And submission is not based upon lesser intelligence at all. And submission does not mean that you must be fearful or timid. It does not mean that you must be fearful or timid. You have to gauge every situation and determine how much of your female influence you are going to have to expend in each situation. That's a challenge. It's not easy. Now, on the other hand, what is submission? Submission is an inner quality of gentleness that affirms the leadership of males in a variety of circumstances and situations. You don't immediately make the decision. You don't immediately take the first step. You don't barge in and take charge. You hold back and you wait. You watch. You listen. You see. You give the distinct impression by your presence, by your attitude, by your dress, by your approach, that you are open to direction and guidance from males. That you are not resistant, that you are not demanding and overbearing, but that you're actually a feminine creature. No fangs, no weapons, no ball bats. You are gentle and affirming in circumstances and situations that you find yourself in with members of the opposite gender. There is a willingness to yield, an attitude that permeates the heart, mind, and spirit of a godly woman. You are willing to yield. You are willing to yield. Now, yield doesn't mean stop completely. It just means let something else go by first, or someone else go by first. How many people like to yield? Well, we don't. Even you get a four-way stop, you know, it's hard. People, I'm going to go. I was here first. Yielding is difficult, isn't it? It's part of that. You know you should yield, but deep down there's this other spirit in you that says, I'm not going to yield. I'm not going to bend. Hey, look me over. Here I am. I've arrived. I'm not going to bow to you any longer. I am woman. Hear me now. And really, it's sad that it had to come to that because, in my opinion, men have not treated women properly in 6,000 years. That they have taken these measures to try to rescue themselves from our clutches tells me a lot about our failure as men. And how much we have lost sight of our role and responsibility. And it's not going to be easy to bring it back. Now, submission also involves obedience. Submission also involves obedience. And remember, a meek and quiet spirit is by God's estimation and in God's sight, what? A valuable and precious commodity. Even if it, and again, would the modern feminist agree with that? Well, that's God's opinion, but it's not mine. A meek and quiet spirit is of great price and value. You can't buy it. To develop it and to nurture it and to help it grow is the male's job and the female's job. And by showing love and respect for females, you can engender that kind of response from them. And by showing respect and submission to males, you can engender that kind of response from them. It works that way, but it's very difficult to make ourselves vulnerable and hold ourselves up to that. Now, let's take a look at a few situations and circumstances in our lives that need these principles in application and in principle to be taken into consideration. For instance, how about singleness, being single? God created us male and female. Not everyone marries. Not everyone marries. And if you marry, not everyone has children. So many of the scriptures detail directives toward husbands and wives who become fathers and mothers and have children. But not everybody is in that configuration, are they? There are two principal figures in the scripture who never married. Males who never married, who were they? Jesus Christ and the Apostle Paul are two. Now, there were others, I'm sure, but neither one of them married. In the kingdom, we know there will be neither marrying or giving in marriage. We'll be like the angels. That's what Christ said. Now, notice in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, singleness is a human condition. It is not a curse. It's a human condition. And many who are single would like to be married, but it may or may not happen. God can open the door for that. Circumstances can come about and make that happen. But it's not always a foregone conclusion. Notice what Paul has to say about singleness in 1 Corinthians chapter 7. He says in verse 7, "For I wish that all men were even as I myself." He was single, and he was talking about being single. Well, that's Paul's opinion, yes. I don't know that God would have the same opinion. He said, it's not good for man to be alone. But this is Paul's perspective. And he says to the unmarried and the widows, it is good for them if they remain even as I am. So he had a particular opinion about that. And notice here in verse 32. But I want you to be without care. He who is unmarried cares for the things of the Lord, how he, or if you will, she, may please the Lord. But he who is married cares about the things of the world, how he might please his wife, or how she might please her husband. So being single has an advantage in terms of your ability to serve God and to serve others. So these are things that all singles should consider. There are certain advantages for males and females. And in Mark chapter 10, certain advantages, but certain disadvantages, of course, for being single. In Mark 10, very familiar concept here, verse 29. Christ said, "Assuredly, I say to you, there's no one who has left house or brothers or sisters, father, mother, wife, or husband, obviously, or children, or lands for my sake and the gospel's, who shall not receive a hundredfold now in this time, houses and brothers and sisters and mothers and children and lands with persecutions, and in the age to come eternal life. So whatever we lose in this life will be provided for us in the next life. So God has made provision for our singleness. And it is not a dishonorable condition. Marriage is not everything. Marriage is not the only thing. Your relationship with God and your place in the family of God is everything. And as you seek first God's kingdom and His righteousness, Christ promised that all of these things would be added to you. Perhaps not in the way or at the time you would prefer, but that's God's promise. And being a single parent is especially daunting. I know there are many single parents out there. Somehow you try to meet your family's needs without the aid of a partner. It's hard enough with two. We had three sons. I don't know. I don't know how anybody could raise three children by themselves. It took both of us, and it took a lot more than both of us had together to do the job. So it is a challenge. So being a single parent is especially daunting. Somehow you try to meet your family's needs without a partner. Your relationship with God becomes especially important during that critical time in your life and in the lives of your children, and hopefully your extended family as well as your church family can be of help and support to you. Now, there are multiple varieties of male and female relationships that we encounter in our lifetimes. From social situations, to work, to school and family, among our friends, etc., these are relationships that can be rewarding and should be rewarding. Now, I've got a couple of hypothetical situations I want to share with you and some quotes I want to read to help illustrate the next portion of the sermon as we start to take a look at the challenges of being single in the workplace, for instance, and being a female in the workplace, I should say. A female in the workplace, or a male in the workplace. What is that like? Well, consider the challenges faced by men and women working together, let's say, in a law firm, where there are lawyers who are equals of both genders, and where a female may find herself in a supervisory position over a male. Now, is that going to prove to be challenging? Probably, but a lot depends on how the individuals handle it. Is it an ideal circumstance? I can't speak to that. I do not wish to stand in judgment of situations and circumstances that are out there in this world right now. But this is a realistic issue that could easily, and I'm sure has arisen, in the lives of many who are listening this afternoon. In a society that is increasingly genderless, it seems absurd to even discuss this situation. Because after all, we're equals, aren't we? We're the same, aren't we? No, we are not the same. We are equal before God in our human potential. But these differences in gender will always come to play, and come into play, rather, I should say, in any and every relationship. It can't be avoided. It is the reality of creation. The intrinsic elements of femininity and masculinity transcend all of our human relationships. Generally speaking, any attempts to reverse the basic roles of each gender will lead to frictions, tensions, issues, and problems. Now, in this case of the law firm, if females and males exercise their God-given traits and characteristics, and the female is open and submissive and willing and interested in hearing out the male, and the male is considerate and kind and polite, I'm sure the relationship could prosper. But if the female establishes herself as the leader over her equal, that may not work very well. All of these dynamics could, and in fact do, take place in the workplace. And a simple answer is simply not there. All each of us as individuals can do is seek to fulfill our role as far as our gender is concerned. And if we're in an intolerable situation and one in which we feel we cannot function or operate, then we may have to find another job. And of course, it's the same in a marriage situation. It's an unhealthy environment if the wife seizes control and attempts to subjugate her husband. In most cases, that isn't going to work. Working against the created order is going to be challenging. And working in concert with the created order is going to be challenging if you're the only one in the office, let's say especially if you're a female in the office, or if you're really a male in the office. Either way, to work within the boundaries and confines of the God-given parameters of your gender and what you should be and be seeking to become is going to be challenging, especially in this world, in this life. You know, there are an infinite number of issues and situations and circumstances that men and women confront every day. There are no pat answers. No pat answers. As men, we are expected to respect, value, and honor all women. Not just our wives, all women. That's what we're expected to do as men. And yet, many times today, if you open the door for a woman or show deference to a woman, I've had this happen several times, she will walk by me and open the other door herself and make a point of walking through the door on her own steam, which is fine. I don't stop her and say, how dare you? I just watch and learn. So our culture is so far away from that. Even the word submission is like a, quote, four-letter word. It's just evil. It can't even be uttered. It's disgraceful. Well, no, I'll never submit. Well, not a wise choice. As women, we are expected to value and exhibit the attitude of a helper and cultivate a meek and quiet spirit in our relationships with all men, not just our husbands. Marriage simply takes these basic gender essentials and enhances and multiplies them in the fulfillment of our respective roles in a divine institution that God designed to depict Christ and the church. Women should relate to men, and wives should relate to husbands as the church relates to Christ. And husbands and men should relate to wives and women as Christ relates to the church. That is the standard. That bar is high. That bar is high. And I'm afraid most of mankind and womankind is down here, way below that bar, doing things they shouldn't be doing. Christ loved the church and gave himself for it. And wives, submit yourselves to your own husbands as unto the eternal, as unto Jesus Christ. So that is the model. And in principle, that applies to male-female relationships. Obviously, there's a difference between the man across the lunch table at work and your husband. But there are principles that can be applied in all male-female relationships that will bring out the best in both of you without the fear, without the tension, the competition, and the strife. And when you extend that, it may not be reciprocated. But nonetheless, you're going to extend it. Now let's take a few minutes to talk about marriage. I want to read a quote from John Piper. Again, he's one of the editors of Biblical Manhood and Womanhood, as I've mentioned several times here. He wrote an article about his childhood, and I want to read the article to you because it illustrates the relationship between his father and his mother and how he viewed it as a small boy growing up in Carolina, South Carolina, in fact. When I was a boy growing up in Greenville, South Carolina, my father was away from home about two-thirds of the year. And while he preached across the country, we prayed, my mother and my older sister and I. What I learned in those days was that my mother was omnicompetent. I don't know if that's a word, but we'll go with it. She had many competencies. She handled the finances, paying the bills, and dealing with the bank and the creditors. I thought only men could do that. Well, of course not. Women can do that. Women can add and subtract. They can do a lot of things. She once ran a little laundry business on the side. She was active on the park board. She served as superintendent of the intermediate department of our Southern Baptist Church and managed some real estate holdings. She taught me how to cut the grass and splice electric cords. She taught me to pull Bermuda grass up by the roots and paint the eaves and shine the dining room table with a chamois and drive a car and keep French fries from getting soggy in the cooking oil. She helped me with the maps and geography and showed me how to do a bibliography and work up a science project on static electricity and believe that algebra 2 was possible. She dealt with contractors when we added a basement and more than once put her hand to the shovel. It never occurred to me that there was anything she couldn't do. And I think that speaks to the strength of both of his parents, the competency of his mother, and of course it speaks in general to the fact that submission does not necessarily mean sitting in the rocking chair enjoying tea and crumpets while your husband is doing all the work, or vice versa. I heard one time that women don't sweat, they glow. Well, that's not true. My mother sweated. It would drip off the end of her long, sharp nose. Sometimes she would blow it off when her hands were pushing the wheelbarrow full of peat moss. Or she would wipe it with her sleeve between the strokes of a swing blade. Mother was strong. I can remember her arms even today, 30 years later. They were big, and in the summertime, they were bronze. But it never occurred to me to think of my mother and my father in the same category. Even though mother did all of these manly things, both were strong, both were bright, both were kind, both would kiss me, and both would spank me. Both were good with words. Both prayed with fervor and loved the Bible, but unmistakable was my father's influence as a man and my mother's as a woman. He never got confused about their genders. They knew it, and I knew it, and it was mainly a biological fact. It was mainly a matter of personhood and relational dynamics. When my father came home, he was clearly the head of the house. He led in prayer at the table. He called the family together for devotions. He got us to Sunday school and worship. I don't advocate all of this. I'm just reading a quote. He drove the car. He guided the family to where we would sit. He made the decision to go to Howard Johnson's for lunch. Now, I would never make that decision. He led us to the table. He called for the waitress. He paid the check. He was the one we knew we would reckon with if we broke a family rule or we were disrespectful to mother. These were the happiest times for mother. Oh, how she rejoiced to have daddy home. She loved his leadership. Later, I learned that the Bible calls this submission. I thought that was interesting enough and a clear enough description of the interplay and relationship between a husband and wife, between male and female, to illustrate the point, the complementary nature of what we're talking about here. Is anyone going to argue that the phenomenon of working women entering the job market basically during World War II and after World War II, to the point that we've come to now in our 21st century, will anyone argue that that has not had a dramatic effect upon the family structure and the raising of children and all of the other component parts of that picture? Of course it has. It's had a dramatic impact. And sadly, I think in most cases, you would be hard put to argue against it not having a negative impact. It has been negative. Sadly, that's what we reviewed in the first of this series. Remember this line from a poem by William Ross Wallace? The hand that rocks the cradle is the hand that what? Rules the world. The hand that rocks the cradle is the hand that rules the world. And yet, why is it that being a housewife, being a mother, is drudgery and it has really no importance and significance? In fact, what we need is child care for preschool children, and we just need to ask the government to raise our children so both spouses can work and everything will be fine, because scores show that children in daycare score higher on achievement tests than children who have both their parents at home. I don't believe that, but that's some of the statistical data that you can find out there. I got another quote here I'd like to read. It's called, it's from a book entitled The High Calling of Wife and Mother by Dorothy Patterson. She writes, "Women have been liberated right out of the genuine freedom they enjoyed for centuries to oversee the home, rear the children, and pursue personal creativity. They have been brainwashed to believe that the absence of a titled payroll occupation enslaves a woman to failure, boredom, and imprisonment within the confines of the home." And I wonder to some extent if she's not right in that regard. You know, a homemaker does her job without the enticement of a paycheck, but her services cannot be duplicated for any amount of money, and her worth is far more than rubies. That's what you read about in Proverbs 31. And speaking of Proverbs 31, is it wrong for a mother to work outside the home? Well, we're going to talk about that in just a moment and try to look at some principles in that regard. But in the Proverbs 31 case, the woman did what? She was a seller of cloth. Remember? She also bought and sold land. Everything she did was to the glory and to the honor of her husband and her family. She was the virtuous woman. And she did many things that some might consider to be outside the parameters of a housewife and a mother. But she did all of those things. She was capable and she was competent, but her priority was her husband and her children. And I think that's the principle that husbands and wives should use to guide themselves in determining what should be done under the difficult economic circumstances that we face in this 21st century. Because many of our wives are working wives and mothers. So I want to make sure that to work outside the home is not a sin. I don't want to give that impression. But there are priorities that husbands and wives, fathers and mothers, must seek and pursue in the context of biblical directives. Economics, high unemployment, illness, injury, unexpected expenses, the specific marketable job skills of each mate, concerns about retirement, all of these are factors in deciding whether or not a mother should work outside the home. And how are decisions like this made? Well, as we read in 1 Peter chapter 3, we are to dwell with our wives according to knowledge and not opinion. Men and husbands should lead and not abdicate. Eve did not offer Adam good advice. But that doesn't mean your wife can't offer you good advice. She is your chief helper. The husband leads the wife and family toward a mutually acceptable and satisfactory decision and conclusion in these and in all matters. And of course, once the decision is made, all in the family work hard to support it and make it succeed. Inviting God's guidance and intervention in the course of making decisions is very important. And as we read in those verses in 1 Timothy, men should be the leaders in praying and asking for God's intervention and direction in the family and His guidance. That kind of loving, considerate leadership and direction will be met with kindness, love, and submission by his wife and the mother of his children. And I should also note in this context that in Amos 3, verse 3, we read that two cannot walk together unless they be agreed. And you know what Mr. Armstrong added to that verse? Does anyone remember? Two cannot walk together except they be agreed and unless one is in charge. He added that as an aside. He didn't pencil it into the scripture. It's not inspired. But in the context of our discussion today, there is a need for decisions to be made in a family. God knew that, and that's why He set the male, the husband, as the leader, the one that should bring the family to a conclusion, not a dictatorial, fist-pounding, my way or the highway, but a considerate, kind, loving directive that brings all factors to the table, that considers everything, and the decision is rendered, and everybody supports it. That's how decisions are arrived at. Not by power and dominion. Leadership based upon the body metaphor is effective leadership. We talked about this a little bit earlier. Every organ in your body is important. Every member of your family is important. Your wife is right here by your side. She's very important. Don't neglect her. Don't overlook her. Don't disdain her. Engage her. Inquire of her. Seek her input, her opinions, her perspectives, her female intuition, her wisdom. You need that. It's not good for you to be alone in the decision-making process. You need her, and she needs you, and your family, your children need you both to work together in the kind of relationship that we read about in Mr. Piper's family with his father and his mother. Now, let's talk a little bit about the allocation of duties within the home and the family. You know, mothers bring nurturing, loving care and concern to the table, don't they? They manage the home, making it a comfortable and protected cocoon that's needed for the growth and development of young boys and girls. God designed it that way. It's the garden of life, if you will. And to be the nurturing, loving caregiver in those early formative years is a wonderful privilege. You're rocking the cradle. You will eventually rule the world. Napoleon had a mother. Think about it. Fathers are primarily the providers and the spiritual teachers, but they're also the support and the encouragement for the mother. We both support and encourage one another. Fathers aren't always leading. In fact, they're always serving. And by serving, they're always leading. It would sometimes help, I think, if we had a better understanding of some of these defined terms and didn't always assume that leadership meant making decisions and walking away. The collaborative, cooperative, mutually respectful conduct of parents in every family, in all aspects of their relationship, is a key component to a family success. Anger, provocation, intimidation have no place in this environment. Mother, as I mentioned earlier, is fully capable of wearing the pants, but she chooses not to do so. She opts to fulfill her role as chief helper. Her respect promotes her husband's love, and his love promotes her respect. Sharing household responsibilities is a wonderful example of cooperation and loving concern for each other, and should be arranged and undertaken within the context of the primary duties of the husband father and the wife mother. And there may be cases where the skills of the wife are in demand in this job market and the skills of the husband are not. So, is the husband staying home and taking care of the family and the wife out being the wage earner and the bacon bringer homer? Is that an evil thing? Are we prepared to cast judgment on that situation? You know, in principle, it would be better and more optimum if the father could find work or did find another vocation. Obviously, that's optimum and that's perfect. But we live in an imperfect world. And there are measures that can be taken by the mother if she finds herself in that situation that can still fulfill her gender-specific roles and responsibilities. Even though she's not there in the house constantly, she can still, by her influence and her relationship toward her husband, still give that same kind of sense of security to the household, to the marriage, and to the family. Because in the case of Mr. Piper, his father was gone quite a bit of time, and mother had to do both things. And in the case of certain situations, it may be temporarily that the mother has to take on the role of earning some money, even as the Proverbs 31 woman did. Now, I assume she supplemented the income of her husband and wasn't the primary wage earner. But even in that situation, you are going to have some difficulties and tensions because the normal order of things has been reversed. And you will have to work very hard to avoid the fallout from that reversal. It's just unavoidable. But I think we have to be careful about passing judgment on situations because every circumstance is unique and we all have an obligation to implement the principles of Scripture in whatever relationship we find ourselves. As I mentioned earlier, can a woman manage the checkbook? Can a man clean the kitchen? Well, I will say yes and yes. I've cleaned the kitchen many times. I don't always enjoy it as much as I would other jobs, but, you know, I do a fairly good job of cleaning the kitchen. I enjoy helping my wife because she helps me so much. I couldn't do what I do if she didn't help me do it. And I would assume that she would say the same thing. She couldn't do all that she does if I didn't help her. We help each other. We complement each other. We're not in competition. We are not in competition. And men and women, husbands and wives, who are in competition are missing the point and they're losing out on a tremendous benefit in life. And I hope I've made that clear as we have gone down the road here in this four-part series. Fathers cannot be as good as they can be without mothers and vice versa. Men cannot be all they can be without women and vice versa. One is not superior or better than the other. Decisions regarding family responsibilities, income, who's going to work, where they're going to work, where we're going to live, these need to be made by husbands and wives. And the husband needs to take the lead, and the wife needs to follow the lead of her husband. In the context that we have discussed, and God's blessing will follow. And of course, our light and example is important as well. Well, I'd like to conclude by sharing an illustration with you of something that happened to me on several occasions in my 25 years of serving in preteen camp. I've been a preteen camper for many years. And over the years, I was involved in asking competent, talented ladies and mothers to become camp directors. What a perfect fit for a lady and a mother to be a camp director with preteen children as campers. Taking care of those kinds of needs was an excellent opportunity for them to use their talents and skills and their natural inclinations and abilities as females. Now, we worked together in all aspects of the camp program, from selecting staff to developing programs and choosing camp locations. We consulted together and organized some very successful camps. I worked for them. I was a counselor of a boys' dorm, and they essentially ran the camp. However, I was there in support of them as well. They exercised appropriate leadership in circumstances that they encountered during the day, and when they needed my counsel and my direction in certain situations and to make certain decisions, they came to me and we talked it over, and decisions were made. We respected each other. We worked together in an atmosphere that produced good fruit and built lasting relationships. We tried to put the biblical principles we have been discussing in this series into action, and it worked. We didn't get up each day of camp and ask each other, well, who's in charge? It wasn't a question of who was in charge. We had our duties, we had our responsibilities, we were working together, and if an issue or a circumstance needed to be resolved that was of sufficient importance, not what are we going to serve for breakfast, but are we going to send a camper home? Or is there some other discipline that needs to be undertaken? That's when we all got together, and they looked to me for the decision. We consulted together, and we came to a decision based on all of our input and the circumstances, and we worked together. It was a wonderful thing. So, brethren, I hope you have enjoyed this series on biblical manhood and womanhood. The challenges before us are immense. We are to be bright lights and examples of godly men and women, husbands and wives, in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation who has lost sight of their roles, even their gender. And they don't understand what God created them to become, and they don't grasp the importance of the basic elements that we have been discussing in this four-part series. So let's ask God to encourage us, inspire us, and lead us toward becoming true men and true women in the image of God.